Good news, Mum.
Has Tom Hiddleston phoned?
I'm afraid not, Mum. It's relating to the zombie apocalypse that we encountered on our last trip.
Oh, the one in the future that I wanted to stop.
Indeed, Mum. If you recall, there were several contributing factors.
Have you found a way to save the NHS from those evil...
No, Mum. I'm a butler, not a superhero. The factor I have been investigating is the worldwide Cherry Bakewell shortage. And I have identified the time and location of a critical meeting that set into motion a chain of events that ultimately led to the zombie apocalypse.
Good work, Latimer. Where do we need to go?
To a place on the River Tamar, between Cornwall and Devon, in the year 2112, 2 years before our visit to Covent Garden with Miss Maguire. Everything revolves around the actions of one man who must be stopped at all costs.
Who is he?
The leader of the International Anti-Cake League. I took the liberty of obtaining a photograph.
That looks just like...
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Hello, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't come across any spoilers for True Detective, which some of us haven't seen yet. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. I do hope you managed to climb into this sweet little houseboat without banging your head. Please take care as you come into the sitting area. The ceiling is rather low. Find a spot on one of the stools or cushions. It's rather cosy, but we're all friends here, aren't we? It's so nice to be back in the Southwest. I was born in Cornwall and spent most of my childhood there, and don't get as many opportunities to return as I'd like. I'm glad to see that even in the future, the River Tamar is just as beautiful as it ever was, aside from the cluster of warehouses on the Devon side of the bank. May I suggest you sit facing the starboard side of the boat, so you can enjoy the best view of mossy trees, twisted roots stretching their fingers into the river, and, if you're very lucky, you might catch a glimpse of an otter.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Adam Christopher.
Splendid! Let's see his calling card. Adam Christopher, writer. Also, finder of ghosts, available for weddings, birthdays, bar mitzvahs. That green dog in the motif looks surprised, and rather familiar.
I don't recognise it, Mum. And may I say, I find it rather odd that one would have a motif of a sickly dog on their calling card.
I think it's delightfully eccentric. Show him in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Adam Christopher is a novelist and comics writer. His debut novel, Empire State, was the Financial Times Book of the Year in 2012, and he has won the Sir Julius Vogel Award as an editor in 2010.
Mr. Adam Christopher, Mum.
Hello, Adam. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's so lovely to see you. Do come and sit on these, like, it's a very kind of low chair, but they are quite comfortable. And mind your head, it's a bit low this
well,
evening.
Well, you know what they say, the lower the chair, the better.
Why?
I don't know, it's just what they say.
Would you care for some tea?
I would love some, thank you very much.
How do you take your tea?
I take it white with no sugar, which is the only way to take it.
I could not agree more. I'll pour. And would you like a jam tart?
I will today, yes, thank you.
Wonderful. Latimer made a rather large batch this morning, so I'm grateful for all of the help I can get.
Well, just keep them coming, and I'll do my best.
Now, before I go any further, I have to ask you about the green dog motif on your calling card, because Latimer was particularly intrigued by that. Where does he or she come from?
Well, it comes from my previous life, where years ago I used to run an internet forum that was named after a green cartoon dog called Rhubarb, which you may be familiar with, or you may not be.
As in Rhubarb and Custard?
Yeah.
Ah!
Yeah, Rhubarb, the original 1970s cartoon, which is like this animated series of 5-minute episodes where it's drawn with felt tip pen.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and so the whole picture is like wobbly and crazy because it's basically drawn. But I love that, and when I started listening to that forum ages ago, for some reason I called it after Rhubarb. And it was really cool because we actually got permission from the people that own Rhubarb to call it Rhubarb, which is kind of weird, but kind of cool. But I've always thought, if ever I had like a logo or maybe a boutique press of my own one day, I would have a green dog as the kind of the symbol.
Now I understand.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I used to love that show, and it had the best theme song in cartoons ever.
And narrated by Richard Bryant.
Yes. Oh, may he rest in peace. I was so upset when he passed away.
Yes.
He was such a great comic actor. He was amazing.
Oh, one of my favourites.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. So, when I invited you to join me in the tea lair, I asked you to bring a curio with you, and I was wondering what you've decided to bring.
I have brought with me my personal Dalek. He's a little clockwork 1960s toy. He's made of tin, and he's blue and silver, and he's very cute.
I'm so glad when you said personal Dalek that you then added later that it was a toy, because that would have been quite
scary.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I've got... Yeah, there's a real one outside, but the toy one, yeah, he's my little mascot.
Oh, good. Yeah. He's going to stay outside, right?
The other one is, yes.
Oh, good, good. Yeah.
He's my minder.
Ah, hang on a moment. Latimer, don't worry about the Dalek outside.
Very good, Mum.
I just thought I'd better tell him, just in case.
Probably a good idea. Mm.
Would you like a cup of tea, Mr. Dalek?
I do not drink tea.
Very good.
Leave the Dalek alone, Latimer. So, is he one that you had as a child, or is he a toy you acquired later?
No, the toy one, I know. I acquired that later in life. One of the great things about being an adult is that you can go and buy all the things that you wanted to have when you were little. But your pocket money couldn't stretch that far.
Yes, yes.
So I embrace adulthood.
By revisiting our childhood love. It is the best thing about being an adult, I think. One of the best things. And being able to eat ice cream whenever you want.
Yeah, it's like the village shop is down the road. I can go and get wagon wheels any time I want to.
It's great. It's great, apart from all of the other really boring responsibility stuff. But, hey.
Yeah, never mind. You need to take the good things we can.
Yes, you do. Now, there's something I've always wanted to ask you ever since I came across it. And every time I see you, and I see you, you know, several times a year, I always forget... So, there is something that I came across some time ago, which said something about you being in a band. Is this true? Have I, like, made this up, or...?
No, it was true. I mean, I played guitar, and I kind of always have since I was probably 13, I think, I started at high school. And it's one of those things where, like, at school, you're always... Because I took music, guitar was, like, part of my lessons, so I was taking it... properly, like as an instrument, but because of that on the side, obviously I was always in bands and things. But yeah, before I moved to the UK, I was in a band called Black Drum. I actually played bass in that. It was a three-piece, and the main guy, probably not very familiar to your listeners, but there's a New Zealand band called Garageland, who were quite successful actually, like proper band
as opposed to an imaginary one.
A band with proper songs. And it was just like Garageland had kind of dissolved, and this was his new thing. Garageland was like a five-piece kind of indie rock type thing. So we were a much sort of more, I guess even more kind of indie. And we recorded some songs, and we were doing an album, and actually we got to number two in New Zealand's, they had like an alternative top 10, and we got to number two.
Really?
Yeah. And like, there's it's not anywhere online. I haven't been able to find it. There's even a music video.
Oh my god!
Yeah, I know.
Do you own a copy of that music video?
No, I don't. No.
Oh.
And as far as I can see, it's not online anywhere either. If you search for Black Drum, Black Drum is actually also a type of fish. So, and there's Red Drum as well, which is another type of fish. So basically, you just come up with all these fishing enthusiast websites. there is some bits and pieces about us online. But yeah, that was like 2003 or 2004 now. So it's 10 years ago. But I mean, I still play guitar. I've got two guitars and a banjo. I'm teaching myself the banjo because one of my life's aims is to play the car chase music from Duke and Hazard. So yeah, I'm progressing on that.
A noble cause, sir.
Yeah, you have to have a hobby.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. That's so cool. So did you have to leave the band because you were moving away, or did you just disband? Or
I think it pretty much ran its course by the time I'd left. I had started something else as well with another person as a kind of duo. By the time we got around to anything, I had moved to the UK. But I've got stacks of rehearsal tapes and things, which are quite weird to listen to. I kind of occasionally, like if an iTunes shuffle comes up as one of them, and I think, oh, that's not bad. And then I remember who it is. And it's like, oh.
Did they just feel like a completely different life?
Yeah, I guess so.
Is that something, I find that really hard to reconcile. Because obviously, since we became friends, you've been very much in the writer phase of your life.
Right, yeah.
And so for me, it's really odd to think of you in a band. It's just such a disconnect.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you have to pick your hobbies. Well, not your hobbies. Well, I guess they are hobbies, but you have to pick what you want to do in life. And it's like, you know, because I was in the band, I used to fence, and I'm a writer now. But, like, trying to fit all that in and, like, be good at them is pretty much impossible. Mm. So it's like, well, I just do music now for my own kind of interest. Yeah, because I still enjoy it, and, yeah, the banjo is hilarious. You know, and the fencing I gave up because we moved, this is in the UK, we moved house a couple of times, and the clubs that I was members of were too far away. So I thought, well, you know, you gotta focus on what's most important. It's life, I'm afraid.
It is. It's a bit like role playing, you know, you don't want to spread your stats across too many things. You want to specialise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I understand that. Now, another passion of yours seems to be Lego. I've seen you tweet a lot about Lego over the years.
Yes.
Is there something that you would really love to be made into a Lego set that hasn't been made yet?
Well, you know, they're doing Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
As a, one of those ones where you can design something and it goes onto this website and people can vote for it, and if it gets enough votes, then Lego will actually assess it to see if it's a viable set. And it worked this year for Ghostbusters. So they're doing Ecto-1, which is a car, and it's the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters, so that's pretty cool as well.
It's wonderful.
I don't know, there's so many things. Well, the great thing about Lego now is that having gone through a real rough patch, they've suddenly figured out like how to do it again, and there's Lego of everything.
Yeah,
like superheroes, there's Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings. I even heard rumors of a Doctor Who set coming later, so yeah, they're really, really good. I love Lego.
Yeah, it's wonderful how they've got the games as well, the computer games.
Yeah, oh, they've totally lifted themselves up, because, you know, they were about to go out of business in like 2006 or so. But then they figured out that they can license stuff like the Star Wars. I think the Star Wars was one of the first ones they got. And suddenly people like me, who are kind of in their 30s and who used to play with Lego as a kid, like I had all the space sets in the 80s. My dad used to go away on business trips and come back with like a suitcase full of Lego sets each time. And of course I don't have any of those sets anymore, and I could probably track them down on eBay, which I'm actually tempted to do. But then things like Star Wars came along, and it's like, the first thing I got a couple of years ago was the Millennium Falcon, and it really revitalized my interest in Lego, because the design is amazing, and really clever, and yeah, so they've captured the whole market of, you know, people like us.
Yes, and probably one they really, well, maybe they did predict it, maybe I'm doing them a disservice.
It's hard to tell. I'm not sure, because they really had gone in a weird direction. They were making sets that didn't even look like Lego, and they were losing a ton of money, and now they're in massive profits, and they're very secure, which is wonderful.
Definitely. Now, you've written books set in an alternative New York, and you often tweet the most wonderful kind of vintage pictures from, like, the Prohibition era and New York. What is it that fascinates you about the city, and in particular, kind of Prohibition era?
Well, I think Prohibition, there's like two things here. There's Prohibition and there's New York. Prohibition has always interested me because it's just so bizarre. They had this idea which is kind of righteous or well-meaning in some way to ban alcohol. because alcohol is a problem, according to some people. And the weird thing is, they had prohibition, and somehow they actually got it through, and alcohol was banned, and then drinking skyrocketed. And all the problems associated with alcohol, like, exponentially increased, because they banned it. So it's a really bizarre kind of time capsule thing of what, you know, the best intentions kind of going wrong. Mm. Yeah, so that's the kind of the first thing. And then New York is a place that I guess I've always felt a fascination for. I mean, I'm really into comic books, and especially, yeah, American, sort of mainstream American superhero comics, which had their origins in New York in the kind of 1930s, which is after Prohibition, but it's in that whole, I guess, general era of the of Prohibition and the Depression, and it's like, that's when you had things like jazz came about, and pulp fiction and pulp magazines. So it was a huge period of creativity. Mm. Which, you know, came out of the Depression, which then followed, which was after Prohibition. Yeah, and then the war came, and it's a kind of really complicated period and really fascinating. And I guess New York of the 1930s kind of symbolizes all that stuff together. And then from that, I became just interested in the city itself, because it's just, it's fascinating. It's huge and complex, and I don't think there's anything, I don't think you can, there's so much to learn about it. You know, in the, its history and also its culture today. It's my it's probably my favourite place in the world.
Would you like to live there?
I'd love to live there, but I don't know if I could ever afford it. Because if you want to live there, it's like anything. It's like your, you know, your favourite place or wherever. It's like if you live there, you really want to, you know, enjoy it. Lee Child in the interviews, because he lives in New York, and he's like, yeah, I'm a writer and I went to live in New York and I live in Manhattan. Because if you want to do that, why not? I'm thinking, yeah, but do you know how many books you sell? It's like he's forgotten somewhere.
Yeah. So you mentioned there briefly your love of comics. I was wondering, if someone said to you, look, Adam, pick the comic you want to work on, which one would you choose?
Well, I need to write Hawk Girl, who is a DC character. I've got her all mapped out. I've got all my plots ready. I've got a whole series in mind. Because Hawk Girl is my favourite character. So, yeah, I'm just waiting for the call, basically. But I think I'm also waiting for the call, to write any of those characters that I love. I'm a superhero. I like comic books. I like comics as a form. I'm a huge fan of superhero comics in particular. So that's probably my kind of, that would be my weak at the knees moment. in my writing career, and a highlight as well, I think.
Yeah. Why is Hawk Girl your favourite?
Because she is an extremely kick-ass female superhero who has an amazing backstory. Well, there's several different versions of her, and she's obviously tied with Hawkman, but they've got the classical story that they were two Egyptian people from ancient Egypt who were in love with each other. And they were killed, and throughout the eons, they are constantly resurrected as Hawkman and Hawkgirl. And when they fall in love with each other, they find each other and fall in love with each other, they die, and then are resurrected. So it's this endless cycle of, well, coming back to life, and the tragedy in that they can't fall in love with each other because that's that cycle again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a huge, that's one history. There are other versions. In one version, she's actually like a cop from another planet, which is great as well. But yeah, it's the whole mythology and the whole character. And I think, you know, the best version of her, which ironically uses the alien cop version, is the Justice League animated TV series, which I'm a huge fan of. She's one of the main people in the Justice League. So came from that and then reading the comics. And I just love the character. She's amazing. I've got a little statue of her in my library. It's like, yeah.
I will have to seek that out, I think. That comic, right? That sounds wonderful. Will you be able to direct me to the best place to start? Because that's always the thing that's intimidating when you're not fully immersed in the comics world and you hear something, you think, oh, wow, it sounds like I'd love that. And then suddenly you're like, oh, where do I start? Which one do I go
from? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But actually, for Hawk Girl, watch Justice League.
Okay.
The TV show. There's like, I don't know, 60 episodes, and she's amazing in that.
Hopefully it will come onto Netflix. We've just started to watch in the evenings the really old X-Men cartoon that I used to watch at university on Saturday mornings, and now we're watching it with the bean.
Gosh, I can't even remember.
Do-do-do-do-do. Do-do-do-do-do. Do 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 you remember that? Do-do-do-do-do. Oh, no, the chickens are going to start. The chickens. Oh, don't mind the chickens. You don't mind chickens, do you?
No,
they're
I
at
don't.
The far end of the boat. Over, they'll start. Oh no, they're coming over. They're coming closer now. They've heard some music. They're a bit odd.
They're attracted by the X-Men theme tune.
Any kind of theme tune, they love them.
Well, different types of birds are attracted by different theme tunes.
As
are you
they?
Know.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So turkeys would be Justice League theme. If chickens are the X-Men theme.
Ah, well, these have sung all kinds of strange things, but. Let's see. Let's season two at the moment. They're just happily pecking away over there.
Okay.
I'm not sure that rug is going to last. But yes, when I invite people into the tea there, I like to ask my friends if they have any questions that they would like to ask if they were lucky enough to have tea. And to do this, I go onto the wonderful Twitters. And one of the questions that was asked was, what was the most unexpected aspect of your transition from aspiring to published author? Or did you expect all of it?
Well, I don't think you can expect any of it, really. That's a really, actually really difficult question. I think one of the things that was most unexpected was the fact that nothing actually changes for you as a writer. You know, writers are perpetually gripped by anxiety and fear and
self-doubt.
Yeah, the certain knowledge that you're going to be, that you're a rubbish and you're going to be found out one day, and then when they do find you out, it's going to be just trouble. So, yeah, and the weird thing is, you get a book deal, you're paid for your writing. And if you have an agent, and this is a kind of weird thing that happened to my brain, it's like, suddenly what you do has value to someone else. Because it's not just you doing it as a job. It's like other people are tied into what you do. You know, your editor, your publisher, your agent and things. But that doesn't kind of change the fact that writing that first draft is really, really difficult. And, I mean, well, you know, obviously sometimes it's enjoyable and sometimes the words just flow endlessly. And then other days it's just the most awful thing in the world. Just trying to get words out. Like today, as it's like, I'm on a deadline, which means I'm getting paid for it. And it's going to be a great book, and I can't wait for it to come out. But today, I was just face-rolling the keyboard. Just going, fix it later. Guy shoots that guy, what for? I don't know. Sounds cool. Oh, no, he's still alive. Oh, I'll explain later.
I want a GIF of you face-rolling on your keyboard.
I'm sure you can find that. Not with me. But I'm sure there's a whole... It should be a whole writer's page of the things that we do as when writing.
Yeah, there's that great Tumblr. What is it? Oh, there was one...
Life and Publishing.
Which is wonderful. And there's another one. Is it Title to Come?
Yeah.
Which I also love. Yeah. They're very, very funny. Yeah, the whole doubt thing. Because I think when you're still aspiring to be published, there's, I think, this kind of hope and very desperate need for some kind of external validation, and that I was hoping that once somebody said, yes, I believe in your writing enough to pay you money and to take financial risk for my publishing house to publish you, that I would then somehow believe that I was actually a writer. But no, it doesn't happen, does it?
No. Because, I mean, obviously, yeah, as we both know, being an aspiring writer, I mean, I don't really like the phrase, but okay, the writer trying to get an agent, a deal or whatever, get published. You know, it's really difficult to get published and difficult to get an agent, and writing is really difficult. That doesn't change when suddenly you have an agent and a book deal or whatever. Writing is still difficult.
Yeah.
I think it probably should be difficult. And like I said, that's just a very general thing, because obviously some days it's great and some days it's not. You know, you're writing 100,000 words that makes sense and is entertaining and logical. It's quite hard work. Okay, it's not salt mining or, you know, whatever genuinely difficult jobs people have, but that doesn't change. And I guess I thought maybe if I had a deadline and someone said, hey, yeah, write a book, you're on contract, it's going to come out, it would kind of be different. It's not. It just means you have to do that work
with more people watching.
With more people watching, yeah. It's different. It is different, but not.
Now, from various things that have been said on the Twitters, it's apparent that you're working on a project with Chuck Wendig. Now, Chuck, the force of nature that man is, what is it about working on a project with Chuck Wendig that scares you the most?
See, now I'm suspicious that he asked that question.
He didn't. That's entirely my question.
Okay.
It does kind of sound like the thing he'd want to know, doesn't it?
Yeah. What do you really think about this? Well, the great thing is that we are completely different writers, different kind of writers. We write different things. You know, I really love his work, but there's no, you know, I'm not, there's no way I could emulate that or try to, because it's different. It's not my thing. And I think the reverse is true of my stuff for him. But that means when we work together, we see things from different angles, which is perfect, because then you put them together and you get something else. And I think we've been surprised at some of the stuff we've come up with, because it's like, wow, this is actually pretty cool, because it's unexpected and we don't know sort of where it came from. But the scary thing, I guess, is, well, it's like that thing where, yeah, you kind of like, well, I hope this is okay. I've got this, yeah, you go, I've got this great idea, it's amazing, write it down, oh, it's going to be brilliant, fantastic. This is the kind of the first stage of writing, the bit where you hate it comes later. But with all writing, it's like, ah, oh, this is amazing. But then you're kind of like, you've got to show it to someone else immediately. You know, no editing, no gatekeeper, no beta reader. You know, it's going straight to the other person, because this is the whole kind of the embryonic phase of what we're working on. You know, and you've got to be able to say that sucks or it's great. Because if you don't say it sucks, and you're not going to get anywhere, because you're going to have all the stuff and you're like, oh yeah, it's great, yeah, oh yeah, really good. You know, you've got to say no, it's not very good. So yeah, I think definitely working as a collaboration is a different kind of work, but it's the kind of thing where, like, because we know each other, it's like we can say, yeah, I'm not sure, or not, I don't know. You know, we've not had any point where, like, the two of us would never completely come from opposite directions convinced that what we're doing is the right way to do it. Only to come against the other person. Yeah, because we're not the kind of persons. So yeah, it's really cool, and yeah, it can be quite scary. He's also a terrifying person. He's extremely mean. Oh, he's got a temper.
He's just a great big pussycat. He really is. I'm so fond of him, and it's always so lovely when we go to the States and we can hang out with him. And he's such a lovely, lovely guy.
It's kind of weird for us in a way, because we have the same agent, Chuck and I. Whatever we do, if it goes through her, she's dealing with both of us. So it makes it really easy, because it's also transparent.
Yeah. You've just, in fact, I think it was last week that I saw you, because there was, or was it the week before? I don't know. I find it very hard to keep track of time now. I run my life by which book I'm writing at the moment, and dates and things go fuzzy. But we recently saw each other at the launch of Hangwire in the Burning Dark. And Burning Dark was, that was actually kind of out early, wasn't it, as a special thing?
Yeah, because it's out on March the 25th. And we had that launch like March the 6th, so it was sort of two and a half weeks early.
So it's space opera, isn't it, The Burning Dark?
It is, yeah.
And is that your first space opera?
The first published one, yeah. I mean, I love space opera, and I love that kind of science fiction, which is actually about spaceships and planets and robots and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of space opera, although it's just set on a space station, although there's a whole kind of backdrop to that. You know, it's set 1,000 years in the future, and humanity is at war with a machine intelligence, this kind of gestalt thing, which humans call spiders, because they build these kind of little, well, not little, planet-sized war machines, which have got 8 legs and look like spiders, and they eat planets and eat spaceships and people. So they're called the spiders, but no one really knows what they are, they don't know where they come from. You can't communicate with them, because they're like this mass hive mind type thing. And it's kind of, they're chewing through space, and there's a war on. So that's the kind of background of it. And then on the space station, this war hero, is his last kind of tour of duty is to oversee the demolition of the space station. But he gets there and no one knows who he is, which is kind of weird, because he's a hero. And the Marines on the space station have all got cabin fever, because they've been stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. The star that they orbit is a really peculiar star. Its light has strange properties. And as the space station gets pulled to pieces and its shielding gets taken off, things kind of get really weird. People start disappearing. The space station's commander is gone. No one knows where he is. And people start hearing voices and seeing things and seeing things in the shadows. And, you know.
So it's quite scary.
Yeah, it's a kind of creepy space opera. Tor, who's my US publisher, calls it a haunted space opera.
Huh?
Which I think is quite cool.
That is cool. Because Titan are publishing in the UK, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So Titan UK, yeah, Tor in the US.
So one of the things I was curious about was the edit process, because I've only ever been published with the same publisher across US and UK, so there was one set of edits. So I was wondering, how is that handled?
I'll tell you when I find out. Because what happened was, Tor bought the book and then two others a long time ago, probably a couple of years, and then Titan bought it last year.
So it had already been done, effectively.
Yeah, it had been done, basically. So Titan basically bought the content from Tor for the first book, for The Burning Dark. There's two others in the series, the second one I'm writing at the moment, and that's where it's going to be interesting to kind of see what happens, because it's going to Tor, because they're my publisher, and then it's going to go to Titan. So I think the idea is that, and this is going to be me speaking with no knowledge whatsoever or experience, but I've heard that basically the editors can kind of get together and talk about it, which is great. So basically you've got two points of view.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because they're both English language territories, so it's not like it's a foreign rights sale somewhere where they're just buying a translation.
No.
They've actually got input from the beginning.
So yes, we are getting low on tea. Now, you've already seen the chickens, and they're working their way closer as they get used to you. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is that if you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be? And we'll see if they know this one.
Okay, my theme tune is obviously The Goodies.
The Goodies! I used to watch that when I was really quite young. I haven't seen it since the 70s, I don't think.
No, because it's never been repeated in the UK.
Has it never been repeated?
It's a tragedy. The weird thing is, it's repeated in Australia and New Zealand to this day. It's massive in the Southern Hemisphere. So I've seen an awful lot of it. Well, I've seen all of it several times over.
Because the theme tune I can remember, and I can remember loving it, but I was very, very tiny, so I don't remember it very well.
Well, I think I can also reveal a secret in that the inside of my wedding ring is engraved with, let me try and get it off, it is engraved with their motto, anything, anywhere, anytime. It's true, I've got it right here.
Oh, that's very romantic. I'm watching the chickens now, the goodies. Oh, yeah, there they go. They know the goodies. How do they do it? It's bizarre. Maybe it's some kind of telepathic thing. Are these telepathic musical chickens?
Yes, all poultry are, to some extent, psychic.
Well, there you go. They know the goodies. Well, I'm delighted. Excellent. Now, normally I would say my goodbyes to you and Latimer would show you the way out, but there's something I was wondering if you might be able to do me just the smallest favour before you leave.
Of course.
On the other side of the river, if you look through that window on that side of the boat, can you see that warehouse over there?
I can, yes.
Well, there are quite a few cars around it, and that's because there's some people having a meeting there in a few minutes, actually. And, I don't quite know how to put this, but they're not very nice people, and they have formed something which we've discovered is called the Anti-Cake League, and long story short, their actions today are ultimately going to result in a zombie apocalypse some years in the future, which I'm sure you'll agree is suboptimal.
Yes, it's below par.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Latimer has pieced together some information, and there's someone who's going to arrive at that meeting very soon, and they bear a remarkable resemblance to you if you were wearing a moustache and a goatee beard. If it's not too much trouble, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind putting on this false moustache and goatee beard, and just popping across the river over there. We've got a little boat ready for you. And going in and pretending that you're someone who calls himself Christoph Adam, who's the head of the Anti-Cake League, and persuading them that they shouldn't go ahead with the plan.
I think that's a very good idea.
Hey! I'm so pleased. I was quite nervous that you might say, well, actually,
Well, come on. Yeah, come on. How can I? He's obviously, there's some evil connection here that I'm been hitherto unaware of.
Yes.
It needs investigation.
Yes, yes, exactly. So I thought if you could just put on the disguise, pop over the river, convince them it's a bad idea, and I'm sure it won't take more than 5 minutes, and then, you know, you'll be home in time for tea.
More tea?
Yes!
Yes.
Excellent, marvellous. Well, here's some of that, what do they call it, spirit gum that they stick moustaches on with.
Oh, yes.
And I'll give you a hand, and Latimer can check it before you go. Oh my goodness, wow. You're really starting to look like him. You don't have a time machine of your own and some kind of evil alter ego thing going on, do you?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I have my suspicions now.
Yes, maybe you will in the future.
Exactly. It's a paradox.
Yeah, well...
Maybe.
Hopefully not, because, you know, that would be bad. But anyway, well, you look great now. Is it comfortable?
Yeah, it's fine, actually. I feel quite at home.
That's slightly worrying as well. But anyway, and just in case I don't have a chance to say a proper goodbye later and all the excitement, I just wanted to say thank you for popping in for tea today.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a delight. And let me just wrap a couple of these jam tarts up for you.
Oh, lovely.
Although I would keep those hidden if you're going across there to the anti-cake thing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not a good plan. Well, we'll keep those back for you, and I'll be seeing you later in the year in London in August.
Yes, you will.
Excellent. Well, take care, and they're not very nice people, so do be careful.
That's okay, I'll be fine, I'm sure.
All right, then. Well, take care, then.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Bye!
This way, sir.
Are you sure this is going to work, Latimer? He certainly looks the part, but I'm not sure if he'll sound like him.
I don't think that will be a problem, ma'am. I'm sure their voices are very similar, nay, identical.
Well, he's almost across the river. He's handling that boat very well.
Hardly Lieutenant Cole, though, ma'am.
Ah, but I think he's exceptional, Latimer.
Yes, ma'am.
He's at the other side. I hope that the spirit gum is good enough for the job. It would be awful if his disguise fell off halfway through. There are a lot of cars outside. I wonder if they still use petrol. Probably not. He's gone inside. Oh, I would feel terrible if something happened to him, Latimer.
Tea, ma'am?
Yes, please. A fresh pot, I think. And a clean cup. That chicken has been drinking the dregs in mine.
Good grief. The indignity.
Hang on. Another car's turned up. Oh, God, it's him. The real leader of the Anti-Cake League. He's going inside. This is a disaster.
Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen it.
But they'll know Adam's an imposter.
No, ma'am. They are one and the same. The Adam Christopher you know is an upstanding gentleman author. But in the future, he invents a time machine and becomes the evil Christoph Adam, nemesis of cakes everywhere.
But Adam is lovely. What could possibly have pushed him into a life of villainy?
Oh, I don't know, ma'am. Perhaps a betrayal from a close friend? But no matter. As soon as they touch, the paradox will destroy them and everyone else in the warehouse. Probably this timeline, too. We'll be safe in the time bubble, of course. It's all part of the plan.
You didn't tell me about this part of the plan.
Oh, did I not, ma'am? I do apologise. It must have slipped my mind.
Slipped your mind? They're shooting at him. How will he ever get out of... Was that the car from Ghostbusters?
Yes, ma'am. The Ecto-1.
I really didn't expect that to happen.
He's more resourceful than I anticipated.
How on earth could he have summoned that car?
He must have activated an emergency signal hidden on his person. There was something odd about that carnation he had in the buttonhole of his jacket. I should have checked it.
He's driving out. At least, I think that's our Adam. It's hard to tell. Oh, he's heading for the boat. It must be.
I'll help him aboard, ma'am, and prepare for our return home. I'll find another point in the timeline in which we can stop the Anti-Cake League.
And be nice to him, Latimer. We have to stop him from becoming evil in the future.
I'll get him a nice cherry Bakewell, ma'am.
Well, As Latimer helps Adam back on board, I'd like to thank you for joining me and the remarkably resourceful Adam Christopher today. Lovelies, all this talk of space opera with Adam has put me in the mood for more. Do you have a favourite space opera that you could recommend? Do be dears and let me know on the Twitters. I'm MApocalyptic over there. Or in the comments for this episode on tnjeopardy.com. Well, until next time, my little truffles. Now, Latimer, do take care of Adam when you take him home. I don't want to find out that he's turned evil because of what we did today.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of TN's Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.tnjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.